We are 8/10 of the way through a series of talks with some digressions over the last few months, looking at a list of qualities that's important in late early Buddhism. That's a funny thing to say. This is a list called the Parami. I say late early because it's not part of the earliest kind of strata of the Buddha's teachings. The Buddha kind of mentions them obliquely, but they really get developed in the kind of commentarial literature shortly after the early texts. And this is a list called the Parami or Perfections. They're considered to be the qualities that that practitioners are encouraged to develop or have to develop, do develop, in the course of becoming Buddhas, which traditionally can take, you know, gazillions of cosmic eons, lots and lots of lifetimes. But we can simplify it in a way to say that these are qualities that are understood as wholesome, first of all, and worth cultivating. And one of the important notes on these qualities is that they're part of what's called the bodhisattva path. A bodhisattva, bodhi means awake or enlightened. Sattva is being, like a human being or a being of some kind. And so bodhisattvas are beings devoted to awakening or awakeness, realization. And bodhisattva also is the word for beings who are practicing toward becoming Buddhas, becoming fully awake, liberated beings, and who are on that path to becoming that. And there's a lot of details about this, that one might make a vow to become a Buddha, and that's what puts you on the bodhisattva path. So there are some traditions where you would do a specific ceremony, kind of taking the bodhisattva path as a formal vow. And it's kind of an amazing thing to do, you know, to sit with a teacher and say, I vow to become fully enlightened, even if it takes, you know, 100 million gazillion lifetimes. And I've done this. And there's a very funny sort of Laurie Anderson story about this. If you don't know Laurie Anderson, she was a New York performance artist in the 70s who made a lot of music, became kind of a pop star in the sort of experimental scene. And marvelous artist. And she tells this story of taking bodhisattva vows with this Tibetan teacher at one point, and afterward kind of freaking out and being like, wait, what did I just promise? You know, and going up to the teacher and being like, I don't know. Can I take it? That was really big. And the teacher being like, no, don't worry. It's okay. You know, it's a way of framing the path. But to take it simply, we can say that when we make a vow to develop ourselves, then that the way that that vow unfolds is that really day to day, or even moment to moment, we're confronted with opportunities for action, and our action in a very simple way is going to be either wholesome, which is to say productive of safety and well-being and furthering the path of realization, or unwholesome, which is, you know, productive of harm or distress or diverting us from the path of realization. And I like the terms wholesome and unwholesome better than good and evil for lots of reasons, partly because the wholesomeness and unwholesomeness lies in not really in the action itself, but in the intention and the conditions that surround it, right? And there are classic examples of this, of saying, like, is it wholesome or unwholesome to plunge a knife into someone's body? And you might think, well, that sounds fairly unwholesome. Unless you're a surgeon, at which point it's quite wholesome to save someone by operating skillfully on them. So it turns out that the cutting of a body with a knife is a morally neutral act in and of itself, but the intention and the conditions, the context in which that act happens, determines its moral weight. And so in the Buddhist sense, that's actually true about everything. That's true about all actions. And so then the practice of acting in a way that is wholesome or conducive to safety for others and liberation is not just a practice of, you know, following a set of rules or guidelines like commandments, but is actually a practice of a kind of ongoing inquiry and wakefulness, right? Where we're not really allowed to go on autopilot in this path. Sorry. Autopilot is very nice in a numb sort of way. But the encouragement actually is to really stay awake. That an action that might be helpful in one instance could be harmful in another instance that looks even similar. And we're enjoined to be really awake to that. So all of these qualities, the perfections, are considered to be kind of guidelines toward the wholesome. And so we've come to the eighth in the list of 10, and appropriately for New Year's, it is resolve or resolution. And the Pali word, the word in the language of the early Buddhist texts, is aditana, and it can also be translated as determination or self-determination or a type of discipline. I like resolve or resolution. And it's an interesting one because when you look it up in the texts, it actually, the same word, aditana, it gets used to refer both to a wholesome quality and an unwholesome quality. And this is rare in the texts. Most of the words have fairly consistent meanings. It's one of the amazing things about the Pali Canon, is that it's fairly internally consistent. This word is a complex word that gets used to mean both the determination to accomplish something wholesome and a kind of fixated worldview where you are determined to hold on to a certain view or perspective, even if it's wrong. And so it refers both to a quality of will, of like positive willfulness, which is how it's used in the perfections, the parami. But it's also used in places as part of a list of like, you know, ways to be confused. After all, I can be quite resolved upon, a particular like political viewpoint, without really taking in a larger picture, right? And of course, you can believe fiercely something that's actually just wrong if you've received wrong information. So aditana becomes this delicate quality, because we actually then have to determine or discern for ourselves what is worth holding on to as a support and a motor for the path, and what actually should be questioned and not held on to. So aditana as a perfection refers traditionally, in the kind of the earliest references to it, to kind of two things. The primary way it's used as a perfection is the vow to become awakened, or the resolve to act in a wholesome way. And so this is a type of will, right? And it's a kind of will that has, it really does have a force to it. And I want to emphasize that partly because so often, especially in Western Buddhism and insight meditation, non-efforting is given a lot of emphasis, right? We're really encouraged to not try too hard and to be gentle with ourselves and to understand that the heart opens and the heart closes, and that, you know, success and failure are two of the winds that blow through and change all the time. And all of this is pointing toward a kind of non-fixation. Don't get too hooked into things. And then Aditana, which not surprisingly, I can say that I have never heard a Dharma talk on by any Western teacher. So I've never heard a teaching on this. Everything I'm giving you, I've gotten from reading the early texts. It's actually a quality of some significant willfulness. And the examples given in early texts are kind of classic archetypal heroic metaphors. It says, you know, the bodhisattva who vows to become a Buddha, even if it is more difficult than swimming across an entire world system that composed entirely of ocean, that would be difficult, but the bodhisattva does not shirk from such a challenge, you know? Even like walking across an entire world system composed of red-hot, glowing, smokeless, fireless coals. One would, you know, walking across an entire world system, you know, walking on blade, like, just like ferociously heroic images. And the Buddha used these images. He was from the warrior class in ancient India. He was trained as a warrior, trained to fight as royalty, which really meant military. And he uses this martial imagery sometimes, not often, but he does. And this is one of those places where it shows up. So what does it mean then for us if we take this as a guideline for spiritual practice? Here I am, a kind of lazy Californian who wants to awaken to the truth of things but not work too hard, but I'm kind of anxious and neurotic, and here I am wondering how to have a spiritual practice. I've left the Catholic Church, and I'm lost, wandering in the wilderness. And I'm like, you know, I hear some teachings, I want to practice. How do I actually lean into the path? And I'll use the new sort of meme-worthy term "lean in" as a translation for Aditana. How do you lean into your practice heroically? Some of what I think is suggested here by the early metaphors is that, first of all, the path is long. So all the descriptions are kind of cosmically long. The bodhisattva practices for incalculable eons. You walk across not just an ocean, but an entire world system, which we can think of as a universe. It's a, you know, composed of ocean. You swim across it. All the metaphors have vastness or hugeness embedded in them. So the path is long. We talked a few weeks ago about patience as a core parami, perfection. So one of these is the kind of determination to keep going, to not think that you've reached the end prematurely, but also not to give up when it seems like it's not going so well. If I was swimming across a vast ocean, undoubtedly I would, knowing myself, relatively soon, feel like it was hopeless and want to give up. And this says, you know, says, no, don't give up. Like, just because it's extremely long is no reason to stop. So there's that. How do we orient toward our path, a path toward liberation, with the understanding that it's long but worth sticking with? And the other thing that we get from the early metaphors is that it's hard, which you know, if you've sat 20 minutes of meditation, you might already know, and if you've sat 20,000 minutes of meditation, you really know that it's hard. If you've tried to do anything in this life, you've probably realized that it's hard. Welcome to Buddhism, the religion where we can say that, right? Right. The first noble truth is that there is suffering, period. So the path is long and hard. Welcome to the new year. So cheerful. Yeah. I know. Yeah, seriously. Aditana has this quality in it, though, that is not just patience or persistence. There are other words for that. But it actually refers to the determination or resolve or vow to accomplish the goal. It's not just like keep going and who knows what will happen next. It's keep your eye on the prize. And this requires a few things that, again, are not taught on very much in Western Buddhism. And the first that really arises for me is faith. Right? At the beginning of the Buddhist path, traditionally, is an encouragement to believe in the enlightenment of the Buddha. Believe that it is not only possible to fully awaken, but this was an ordinary human being who did so, and who laid out a path that we can also do, and who guaranteed that it's possible to do so. And in the beginning of practice, which might be the first few incalculable eons, but or for us at least, say, the first few decades of practice, we might or might not believe that. Like, you might or might not be a faith type. Yeah? And especially nowadays, a lot of folks come to Buddhism out of the faith religions, right? I grew up Catholic. I was encouraged to believe in the virgin birth and to believe in transubstantiation and to believe in the assumption of Jesus bodily into heaven and the resurrection and all that. And when I left it, you know, I left it for lots of reasons, not least that I was 16 and it was boring. But if I wanted to get philosophical, I would say I didn't actually believe that stuff. Like, it hadn't been taught to me convincingly enough to really take it on. And so I think when folks leave the faith religions and come to something like Buddhism, which is a kind of rational, humanistic kind of psychology in a way, faith is often really left aside also. Like, oh, you don't have to believe in anything. Just be present, be mindful, take things one moment at a time, learn to focus, all of which is true. But if that's all that we're doing, at some point, I think, and I say this knowing a lot of senior serious students, people who practice 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years, at some point, just that, just practicing moment to moment, being mindful, being awake to the present, is actually not enough in the face of the difficulties that arise in the path. It's tremendously difficult to look at every corner of my own psyche and all of the ideologies and the belief systems and the way that systemic oppression and suffering is woven into my own being, both as victim and perpetrator, and that I'm embedded in systems of chaos and suffering that are, you know, that fill this world system. That stuff is hard to look at. And then down some layers from that, you know, the fragility of the sense of self itself. Hard to look at. What takes us through those moments halfway across a world system-wide ocean, no shore in sight? One of the things traditionally is believing in the goal, the final end goal. So you believe in the enlightenment of the Buddha, and this is something to chant each morning or to remind oneself of, to read the stories of, to talk about. And then aditana, this resolve or this vow, becomes the vow to attain, the vow to arrive, you know. So it says, I'm going to walk to New York. I know it's long. It's not just going to be just put one foot in front of the other, because at a certain point that starts to really drag. It's going to be keep thinking about New York. And this is a delicate teaching, because kind of end gaining or what we would call in sort of wilderness terminology, peak bagging, right? Peak bagging is when you're a hiker and you don't care about the beauty of the entire hike. You just want to get to the top of the mountain and write in the logbook that you got there and just be like, yep, I did McKinley, I did this, I did that, you know. But you didn't really actually notice where you were. This is a strong tendency in our culture to get sort of goalish and not present. And I don't want to emphasize Aditana in a way that amplifies that shadowy tendency. But there's got to be a middle ground. In the earliest strata of the texts, the word was used differently. And it was used in a very interesting way relative to modern culture. And Aditana, or a resolve, is a mental activity of intention that causes something to happen. And traditionally it's used like this. You have a lot of concentration, so you've really, really practiced meditation until your mind is very, very still. And when the mind is extremely still, still enough that you've entered states called jhana or dhyana, deeply unified mind states, no thoughts for hours at a time, profoundly stable energy. There are states like that where if you then think something or you intend something to happen, it will happen. Not material world things like, may I now become rich? First of all, that's a misuse of concentration and so unethical or unwholesome. And because it's unwholesome, it causes friction in the mind and therefore you're not really in concentration. It tends to not happen. Right? This is why it's sort of hard to become an evil sorcerer. although the texts do contain people who did so. The pathway is the same, but the skill is the same, right? You learn deep concentration. You can become an evil sorcerer or a, you know, powerful bodhisattva. I encourage the latter. You know, although if you have powers and you don't know what to do with them, you know, come and we'll talk. And there's a, you know, there's some political transitions happening right now that could use a little force, a little aditana. The resolve in the earliest texts is this. You get the mind extremely still, and then you make a resolve for either a shift in mind state or a kind of energetic shift, and then it will happen. And so one of the classic resolves is you're going to enter a state where you're so stilled that there's no perception of the movement of time or space at all, and you would make a resolve, an aditana, to come out of the state at a certain time. And it's a way of pre-programming yourself to wake up from these deep meditative states. I have one of my grandmother teachers, my teacher's teacher, was very good at this, and she and her daughter, who was also good at it, would say, okay, we're going to enter this samadhi, this deep meditative state, and we're going to come out, you know, let's say it's like Monday afternoon. We're going to enter the state, and we're going to come out Wednesday morning at 9:35 a.m. And they would be like, okay, enter the state. And they would just drop into this extremely stilled, radiant, whatever, extraordinary state, and at 9:35 on Wednesday, they'd come out. This works. If you want to test whether it works, and you don't have that kind of concentration yet, you can test it in relation to sleep. And it's actually pretty easy to do. So as you're falling asleep, you say to yourself a time in the morning. You say, you know, 7:30, 7:30, 7:30. So I say it like maybe a couple dozen times, and then just fall asleep. And I've done this myself for 20 years or so with... my guess would be like a 95, 98% success rate. Almost always it works. I'll wake up a few minutes before the time I said. I can't tell you exactly why it works. Maybe the neuroscientist types can, if you know, tell me. But it works, and it's a type of resolve. And what it does is it uses the power of a certain mind state to affect subsequent mind states. So as you're entering deep mind states, you could make a resolve this is what's done in my tradition up at Spirit Rock. If you get good at these states, your teacher will say, okay, when the mind is really still, just say to yourself, during this morning's sitting, may I have the deepest insight into impermanence I've ever had. You'd say it a few times and then let it go. And then you just see what happens. And if you're concentrated enough, it's probable that something will show up. Or if you're practicing concentration states, you would say, may I enter, you know, first jhana. And not too many questions about jhana, but we can talk about it someday. It's inappropriate for a beginner's day, unless you're very talented. And if you are, you already know it. So, but you would make a resolve for it. And again, this is taught in my tradition. And the resolve helps. You have to be careful with these resolves. I have a practitioner friend who was on a long retreat who was actually much more concentrated than she thought she was. Was kind of just having a wonderful couple weeks on retreat. You know, mind was quiet, feeling good. She's out for a hike on the land. And only later did she notice that she hadn't really had like a distracting thought for a couple of days. Let that soak in. Right? Hmm. She'd been sitting and walking and she hadn't been distracted in a couple of days. And she was like, oh, I think I'll do this dance that I learned in a different tradition, and it happens to have a sort of resolution quality in it. She did this dance, she made a sort of bold wisdom resolve to sort of see something very clearly. And then she went back down to the hall and sat, and over the next couple of hours, one of the most profound and shocking kind of experiences of her life unfolded. And later she went, she went to tell her teacher. Her teacher was like, huh, what did you do just before that happened? And she was like, oh, I went out and did this thing. And the teacher was like, oh, and you asked for what? She said it, and the teacher was like, what do you think? You ask for things in states like that, they happen. And my friend was like, oh. Like, she was kind of innocent to the whole thing, which is beautiful. But this is a resolve. This is adhidhamma. So what it proposes to us, to finish with this, as a way to think about, you know, New Year's resolutions, haha, whatever that means, the thing you do to orient yourself toward wholesomeness, and then we joke about just, you know, forgetting within 2 or 3 weeks, is there is actually this quality that we can summon or embody, but it needs support. It needs the support of perhaps a tradition or the faith in something. It needs the support of states of mind or conditions that help it to manifest, you know. If your resolve is to stay sober, finding yourself in Vegas at parties over and over and over is going to be perhaps an unsupportive condition for that thing, for that resolve, right? So you can make the resolve all you want. The thing that actually helps it along is a state of mind. And that state of mind is going to be one where there's some focus, there's some mindfulness, there's some kindness and relaxation. And then the supportive conditions around you. So in a way, if you're making New Year's resolutions, which, not to be snarky, is a wonderful thing to do, one way to practice with them is to go further than just the resolution, but to actually ask yourself, what are the states of mind or mind-body, and what are the conditions, social, physical, etc., that are the natural supports for that resolution to happen. Particularly if you can identify the mind state or mindset that encourages that resolution to be successful, and the mindset that pulls you away from it, then you have a sense of what to work on. So, adhidhamma, resolve or determination, beautiful quality of will, I'll pause there for now. Thanks for listening. Take a moment and just settle back into yourself. See what's bubbling around. And then for the last 15 minutes or so, last chunk of our time together, just some space for a discussion, for questions, for responses to teachings, to anything about your own practice, whether on this topic or others. Good to have you. Take care. Any thoughts?
If so, what state of meditation were you at, and what were those atitanas, and did they come true?
Yeah, I certainly have. I've done the practice of making resolves, and sometimes they have more of an effect than others. You know, I'll really notice that the ones that feel like they really landed, like I made the resolve and I really noticed a shift happen, were at my most centered times. So one of the strongest supports in terms of meditation for resolves to come to fruition is concentration. And so in a very simple way, when I wasn't as concentrated, not much happened. When I was more concentrated, more happened. And generally, in meditation, that's a little bit the equation. Like, so much hinges on whether the mind is stable, relaxed, and focused. And so, when I had those qualities going, the resolves, the aditana, worked. And generally, my resolves were one or two things. They were either a resolve toward a deeper concentration state, like, I'm concentrated, may I get more concentrated? Sometimes that would happen, sometimes not. Or they were, like I mentioned, what we would call wisdom resolves. And in my tradition, they would generally be resolves. They're sort of like invitations for insight. I would say, may I have an insight into impermanence or suffering or not self during some period of time. And for me, those were subtler. My insights into those qualities often didn't happen directly in relation to resolves. It more felt like doing the wisdom resolves was a way of reminding myself to look for that quality. So like, I'm practicing along, I would only do these on retreat. That's a good thing to say in relation to meditation itself. Mostly because in day-to-day meditation, again, unless you're very talented, most of us don't have the concentration for these things to be successful. And they're not useful as a sort of ongoing, like, don't use them as affirmation practice, like every single sitting, may I have a such and such. That starts to feel just like greed, I think. But also, I don't know that many people for whom that would work, because they really do take some degree of concentrated focus for anything to happen. So I would use them only on long retreat. And then the wisdom ones are nice, I think, partly because it reminds you to look for a certain quality. You know, if you were going to use them in daily life, I would almost use them just as a soft intention, you know, a way of focusing your practice to say, like, today I'm going to try to observe change. Like, I'm going to try to notice when I think things are stable or when I see them changing. I'm going to notice, you know, oh, look, I'm in a different place now. Oh, look, my mood shifted. And use the resolve, in a way, just as a suggestion to remember a given Dharma teaching at different times through the day. Yeah?
Completely answered. Thank you.
Awesome. What else?
the idea of kind of having to swim across a universe of an ocean to get this, or walk across a universe of hot coals, right? And it really kind of, and this idea of faith, because I haven't heard it spoken about in Buddhist, in a lot of the teachings I've been in either.
But there's
something really, like a sense of letting go in that, right? It's so overwhelming, right? It's not like it's a goal that's like, okay, well, I'm going to walk up to Mount Tam from here. You're talking about New York, right? So that's it's like almost like beyond comprehension, right?
Right.
And the quality of letting go is really interesting, because there's an element of, it's like this wholesome desire to get somewhere, but it's also kind of letting go and trusting, in something.
Right, they make the distance so vast that you can't possibly accomplish it through force of will.
Right.
Right? Like, it's interesting that you say Mount Tam. When I was in my 20s, I was captivated by a British performance artist named Richard Long, who does very long walks as his form of art making. And three different times, I walked from my house in the Mission, 21st in Alabama, in San Francisco, to the peak of Mount Tam. And it was an 11-hour walk. And that was a walk that I could do in essentially like one arc of will. I would just decide to do it, leave at the right time, walk all night. I always did it on full moon nights, and I had a sort of pride in never using a headlamp. I would just walk through the through the headlands in the dark and then climb the mountain at dawn. Nice practice, very nice. Like, that I could do in one arc of will, but I couldn't get to New York in one arc of will, right? I would get, like, it's like, oh, I'd get out to Walnut Creek and then be tired, right?
Sorry.
And then you got, sorry. And then I have to figure out, in a certain way, how to keep walking, which also means how to rest and keep walking and rest and keep walking. And Aditana, in a certain way, is a way of saying, like, just don't forget where you're going, even though, like, the path is actually kind of like this, you know, it feels like it sometimes. And I used that phrase, eyes on the prize, which, of course, was an old phrase from the civil rights era, right, for, like, oh, this is a really long path toward justice, so it's going to wind a lot and be really painful. Just don't forget kind of the ultimate, even as you're fully engaged in each step, and it's going to feel like hot coals a lot. And so there is a letting go in that. I think it's beautiful that you're pulling out that quality, you know. And it's such a paradox, right? You let go, and so then you become very sort of momentary. Like, here I am engaged in this step, that's all I can do. And at the same time, you haven't forgotten that you're doing this vast thing. Yeah, I like that very much about this, this thing. You didn't want to share their New Year's resolution? Got any good ones? I kind of stopped doing them some years ago, but only because they were sort of the same every time.
Less sugar.
Right, less sugar, yeah. Right, and then, which is a good one, I think that's probably many people's, and we would want to be like, okay, so, you know, what's the mind state that supports that, right? And what are the conditions that support it? You know, so you can purge the fridge, first of all. It's a condition. It's a material condition that helps, because it's just, you know, whistling at you from the other room. And but then, like, there's a mind state, and so many resolves come down to dealing with craving, dealing with, like, momentary bursts of wanting that constrict the heart and sort of put, you know, blow my intentions away from myself. So much of the mind state is, the kind of focus that keeps me with that, right? How do I keep remembering that that's my intent, even as I walk by Tartine and they blow that smell out into the street? What do you say?
Thank you.
Yeah.
There's so many metaphors that I really, really resonate with at this time, and I don't necessarily make New Year's resolutions, and I don't necessarily even celebrate New Year's in this moment or this like time frame.
Totally.
I'm really into like a couple words of intentions that kind of like resonate throughout the year, which is just more for fun and to share. And currently what I find that I'm using this kind of energy for that this community is really like, as in like maybe Bay Area or like America, around the New Year's, is actually a refocusing on that connection to wholesomeness and state of mind and faith. I was recently at a gathering around community organizing spirituality, so you had people from all faith traditions, agnostic and atheist, and it's really cool because one of the many things I like that landed for me was that I had faith at some point in anything. I just in order to deal with some past trauma. And I kind of, along the way, have been walking and walking and walking and walking and walking. And now I'm kind of at a little bit of a rest corner.
Yeah.
To another continuation of walking. And it's like, whoa, where's my faith? Where is my mind state? And so it's really cool to, like, gather those up and refocus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a really interesting place to be around letting go, actually. Refocusing.
Yeah. Right on. Blessings with that. Yeah. And it's a beautiful way to talk about it, you know. We have these cycles of action and then we kind of pause, we turn a corner, right, very much. We can remember, when you say refocusing, I think about like, even just remembering that I'm headed somewhere, right, is useful, right? I've gotten lost in that sort of canyon, Utah, and I'm like, wait, I was going to New York, you know. When I was 23, I was hitchhiking across the country, which I did a bunch, and at one point I got really, really stuck in this, like, little tiny town in Nebraska. I was trying to get a ride, and I couldn't get a ride, and I ended up having this sort of run-in with these people who didn't like a wandering hippie running through town. and I was kind of just angling for a ride between these different sort of travelers that had stopped, and this one sort of angry local came over and just like kind of dominated my sort of space at some point. You know, just this little like little California hippie, right? This big guy in Nebraska, and he had learned sort of what I was doing, and he really, really wanted me to leave it. I think it was like the sheriff or assistant or something, and he just came to me, and he wanted me to stop like talking to these people and trying to get a ride. And he pointed to the interstate, which was right over there, and he pointed east. He said, "New York is that way." And it was just like, get out of town, right? And I was like, cool. So I just walked out onto the interstate and started walking, you know, and figured, like, I'll get a ride when I get a ride, but let's not be in this guy's town anymore. But it was sort of, it was great. It was just like, you know, you get kind of swirled up in, like, whatever little process you're in, and then some big force comes along and is like, that way. New York is that way. You know, I want like the big Buddhist sheriff at some point to come along in my life and be like, enlightenment is that way. I'm like, oh, I got confused for a moment. Thanks. Thank you very much. Yeah. What's that?
So you were talking about these deeper states of meditation. I forget what you were calling them. I mean, all this.
Jhana is the word.
But there was another one started with an S.
Oh, samadhi.
Samadhi,
is
that like the stage before?
No, samadhi is like the overarching word,
okay.
Meaning like kind of unified mind states.
Okay. And you were talking about like setting intention while you're in that state can have a lot of power. And you talked about a couple different kinds.
Yeah.
One was to a resolve to deeper states of peace and concentration. And another one was to have something revealed, or you think you called them wisdom.
Yeah.
Aditana.
Aditana is the the old word, but resolves is the transition.
But I was wondering, like, when you first were talking about it, I was thinking, oh, well, what about resolves? Because those all seem like selfless, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. What about, like, resolves that were more like, I resolve to, like, oh, I just keep coming up in my meditation practice that I'm just, like, really pissed at my mom, you know, for example. Not that I mattered.
Like, just as an example,
my friend is pissed at her mom.
Totally.
And if those types, if that is ever a thing that people do in those states, you know, I resolve to forgive my mother.
Hmm.
And it seems like a more like personal thing of like, okay, this, let it be so. Like I am done with this.
Yeah.
And like it is, I'm letting it go.
Yeah.
And is that an aditana?
I would call that an aditana. Yeah, this is, we do this in ritual a lot, you know, and ritual is a way of changing your mind state.
Right.
Right. So you get into a charged state, and then you, you know, you make a prayer or
declare
a wish. You declare something.
Yeah.
You write it on a piece of paper and burn it. You do something to say, I'm going to give this intention a little more force.
Uh-huh.
You know, and so... yeah, so the main thing that I would encourage in this context is simply the inquiry of, like, is it wholesome? You know? And so, like, something like, I vow to forgive my mom, this is a beautifully wholesome intention, right? Forgiveness is wholesome, generally. And so you could say, you know, what are the states, take care? What are the states that support that, you know, and the context that supports that? Like, where would we have to be? If I wanted to, like, forgive her actually in person, what would be the, like, situation that would support that versus one that might not be so supportive?
Mm-hmm.
Or if I was doing it just in myself, what would I need to feel supported to do that? Would I need to talk about it with a certain friend or do a ritual or, you know, build something that symbolized my anger and then take it out to the woods and burn it? Like, there's so many ways that you could say, how could I charge up this thing that I want to do so that the forgiveness actually had the force I want it to have. In other words, so that it actually worked, basically. So that it wasn't just words.
Mm-hmm.
And so the aditana would be, you know, I vow to do this, like, to be successful at this. And then you would go kind of assembling the conditions for that. We can remember that these paramis are something that you are enjoined to cultivate slowly over the course of, you know, a long period of time. So,
you would come back to the resolve.
You would come back to it again and again, yeah. Yes.
I practice in the morning. Would it help to manifest my intention by doing it before bedtime?
I would just experiment and see what seems to work. Right. What we're really talking about is, you know, we think things all the time.
Mm-hmm.
How do I lean into specific thoughts or feelings that are wholesome, that are worth leaning into, and give them the support to really manifest, right? And again, this is mostly about manifesting states. It's not so much about manifesting, like, how am I going to manifest a new car? There's not an aditana for that. You make some money and you buy it. It's fairly straightforward.
No, I have something very simple. Yeah. I'd like to manifest a better sleep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I imagine that instead of thinking about my breath?
You can. You totally can. And... in a certain way, there's a whole body of practices that you could work with to work on sleep that are things like, you know, in the period like get off screens 2 hours before you're going to go to sleep, or, you know, do specific things in the period before you sleep to be able to settle yourself and do the various things. There's specific exercises to do, but one of them built into that can be aspects of intention, right?
Creating the right environment that's conducive to
right.
success.
So part of those are creating the environment, and then part of it is creating the mind state. That's helpful. That's our time. We should stop. It's a pleasure talking about this with you. Blessings with your resolves. So we'll continue in this way. as always, this group is offered within the beautiful practice of the gift economy. And that's an offering where we invite you to practice the first of the perfections, the perfection of generosity, by making offerings of your resources, money and other things, if you want, to support this group. It very much is not just a love offering, but actually does, it is the motor that keeps the whole thing running, both for the studio and myself. So thank you for that and for your generosity. It's been a beautiful practice to be able to offer this group in this way for many years now. So donations go in the little basket on the shelf, and I'll see you next week.